Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for all of you today. My guest will be Gwendolyn Hall-Smith. She is the founder and executive director of Global Community Initiatives. And we'll talk a little bit more about what Global Community Initiatives does. And also, I brought her on to also talk about public banking, which has come up in some of my conversations in the past. And she is an expert on that and knows a lot about it, so I wanted to talk to her about that as well. So she'll be coming on in just a little bit, but first I wanted to share with you some things going on in the news, some events in our area that you may want to participate in, and of course share my weekly recipe with you. So first I just want to acknowledge that our summer is coming towards a close, and while I'm very sad about that because I live for my summertime and my gardens and all that, it's also time for so many people around the country to get ready to go back to school and such. And for many people in our local area, and I'm sure across the country it's the same, getting together all those school supplies is a real burden for their families. They just don't have the funds needed for all of the supplies that they need. And so very often there are many wonderful nonprofit organizations working to raise funds and supply school supplies to those kids in need. And locally here on Long Island, we have Community Solidarity, which is a very wonderful organization that I've talked to all of you about before. They provide food at 5 different locations throughout the week, food that they recover from stores that would otherwise just throw it out. And so they save it from going into a landfill, perfectly good, delicious food, predominantly organic, all vegetarian, mostly vegan, food that they hand out at these different food shares. This time of year, they also help gather school supplies. And so on my website, on my front page on my blog, you can find out all the information about Community Solidarity, where you can go to donate school supplies. There's also a link to a page where you can donate financially for them to buy school supplies. But they will supply hundreds, if not thousands, of backpacks stuffed with notebooks and pencils and markers and even computers. So please think about supporting wherever you are in your area kids that might need help with school supplies. And also you can think about volunteering with Community Solidarity. Like I said, they're a really awesome organization. Also, I want to share with you that the other morning I was listening to a story on NPR about loneliness and about social isolation. And that seems to be a issue that is really getting some attention now because so many people are not having the same kind of interactions and are not part of a community the way it used to be naturally occurring in our society. And very often now it's not. There's a lot of isolation. People are working from home. People go on the train and they're just staring at their phones. People watch movies at home instead of going to the movie theater. There's a lot less naturally occurring interaction with people. And for many people who don't have a social circle that they feel like they're a part of, they become very isolated. And they actually shared a statistic that amongst men between the ages of 50 and 54, suicide rate has gone up 50% since 1999. I mean, that's huge. More than any other age group. And they are relating a lot of it to the fact that, males, if they are divorced or separated or never married, you know, very often it's the woman, you know, taking the role of being the social calendar and connecting people. And very often they're alone. You know, they might see people at work, but then they come home and it's just them. And so, of course, they can go to the gym, they can, you know, find some activities, but loneliness is really seeping into so many people's worlds, and even young people. I mean, the interactions that we have now are so much more superficial and so often take place through the internet and not in person. And so this story is really talking about how we need to invest time in our relationships, that investing time in relationships is as important to your health as eating well and exercising, and maybe even more so. So it was really fascinating. You know, they were talking about mortality rates, about, you know, people who have community and friends, you know, live longer, you know, live a lot longer than people that are lonely. So don't think of going out and socializing with your friends as wasting time at all. Go out, have fun, and make those connections, and talk to strangers, you know, on the train. Start up conversations, taking a walk, start up conversations. Don't be afraid to interact with strangers. You know, you just never know what can happen. So I also want to share with you, you know, I try not to get too politicized in this news broadcast here, but we're in a very unique time, as we all know, with the current administration. And the more we can upseed some of the Republicans holding us down, the better we are. And we actually have a chance for the first time in 25 years of unseating Republican Peter King here on Long Island with a young woman named Liuba Gretchen Shirley. And she's running for Congress against Peter King, and it actually seems like she might have a chance. She's being endorsed by Emily's List, the National Organization of Women, Our Revolution, the United Auto Workers Union, Vote Pro Choice, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Governor Cuomo. She has a lot of endorsements, and I am joining on to endorse her as well. And there's a fundraiser for her taking place in Seacliff on Sunday, September 30th from 3 to 5. And if you are in our local area, you know, we've been talking about politics and how we really need to get involved in local, our local government, and this is an opportunity. So if you can do it, you can find a link on my website to purchase a ticket to this fundraiser. Also, there's lots of events going on in the New York area that I want to share with you. Of course, coming up on September 6th, is the Rise for Climate, Jobs, and Justice March in New York City. And across the nation, the day for that is September 8th. It's a big climate, jobs, and justice march in Washington, D.C., and there will be sister marches around the country. But in New York City, because of a conflict with the West Indies parade on September 8th, we are celebrating marching and coming together on September 6th. At 5:30 in the evening at Battery Park City. And so I hope to see you there. I will be there. And it's really essential that we all show up, stand up, and, you know, and come together to fight for climate change. We are living during an administration that is denying climate change even exists. And he's rolling back all the regulations that Obama administration had put in place, and even prior administrations have put in place. And so we really need to come together to fight that and let our voices be heard. So I hope to see you in New York on September 6th. September 8th, I know locally on Long Island there's a big march in Long Beach that you can go to, or Washington, D.C. On September 22nd, there's the Long Island Progressive Coalition is having a climate change workshop at the Sisters of St. Joseph in Brentwood from 10 to 3. And that is talking about our local action, what we can do for climate change as well. So the Long Island Progressive Coalition is working here on Long Island for some of these great things. Wherever you are located, find organizations that you can align with in your belief system and become active. You know, it doesn't matter which topic you pick, but there are so many issues that need attention, and we all need to participate in some way. So, you know, figure out what issue is closest to your heart, and please become involved and help make a change. September 24th through the 29th at Agritech in Brooklyn, there is a curated week of workshops. That is, and they're working with the Sustainable City Movement. And you can find links to all of these things on my website. Also September 25th, Slow Food North Shore. Our local Slow Food chapter is having a Snail of Approval dinner at the Perennial Restaurant in Garden City. You can find out more information about that. Also, Stone Barns is having their big gala celebration on September 25th up in Tarrytown, where the Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture is. And it's a wonderful place if you've not been there. And this is a fundraising event. So it's a bit pricey, but you can go online. And if you can swing it, it certainly will be a good time. October 3rd, Food Tank Summit is coming to New York City. If you have not had the pleasure of participating in a Food Tank Summit, I highly recommend it. They put together a great lineup of speakers, and it's just a wonderful day. So I will be there in New York. It's taking place at the Tishman Auditorium on the NYU campus in New York City. Also on September 6th, there is a Harvest Table Dinner and Family event from 10 to 3 p.m., and that's at the Garden Lounge. But where is it? It's not saying where it is. I'm sorry. But you'll find it on my website. And then November 3rd, the Long Island Food Conference is coming once again to Long Island. This year it's going to be at LIU Post in Brookville. And we have a great lineup as well. Francis Moore Lappe will be our keynote speaker. Tom Colicchio will be on a food policy panel. And we have a lot of other wonderful people coming on board. So mark your calendars for November 3rd at the Long Island Food Conference. And December 1st and 2nd is the 8th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference, taking place up in Southbridge, Massachusetts. And again, all of these events, plus many more, are on my website at ieatgreen.com, so check those out. I also wanted to share my weekly recipe with you. This week I made Mediterranean stuffed vegetables. I just was harvesting so many vegetables. Of course, a few of my summer squashes got a little bit larger than ideal, so they were perfect for stuffing. And I had some Asian eggplants and some big poblano peppers. So I decided to just stuff them all. So I made this stuffing and stuffed the different vegetables. So I had one large zucchini that I cut in half lengthwise and scooped out the inside. And the inside, I didn't throw it out. I actually diced it up and used that in the stir fry as well. One large summer squash, also cut in half lengthwise and the inside scooped out. Two Asian eggplants cut in half lengthwise, the inside scooped out. Three large poblano peppers cut in half lengthwise, the seeds removed. One onion chopped. One pint cherry tomatoes. Two carrots diced. One stalk celery. Two cups of green beans. One purple pepper. One bunch of collard greens, the stems removed and chopped. Two cups of kale, the stems removed and chopped. 2 teaspoons chopped garlic, 1 tablespoon dried oregano, 1/2 cup of white wine, 1/2 cup of fresh basil chopped, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 2 tablespoons chopped parsley, 4 cups of cooked brown rice, 1/2 cup of organic Kalamata olives sliced, 1/4 cup of capers, and 1/2 cup of pine nuts. So I started by cutting the squash, the zucchini, and eggplants and peppers all lengthwise. I brushed them with a little olive oil. I laid them face down and roasted them in a 375-degree oven for about 15 minutes, just until they were soft, because they're going to cook more with the vegetables in it. And then I removed them from the oven, let them cool. And meanwhile, I sauteed the onion in olive oil until they were translucent. I used a big wok for this. I added the carrots and the celery and cooked those for 5 minutes or so. Then I added the garlic and the oregano. While that was going on, I also blanched the green beans. So I brought a pot of water to a boil, put the green beans in, and cooked them just for a couple minutes. When they were done, I removed them, put them into a cold ice water bath, and then drained them and laid them out on a towel and dried them. And I'll add those to the stir-fry towards the end. Then I diced the inside of the squash, the zucchini, and the eggplant and added that to the wok and sauteed for about another 5 minutes. Then I added the purple peppers, the collard greens to the wok and continued cooking that. Then I added the white wine and the kale to the wok and continued cooking. And the white wine helped to steam the collard greens and the kale. And so that's really, you know, a nice way to help. You know, you can put the cover on it even and let it, let the greens wilt and get soft. Then I cut the green beans that I had blanched in half or thirds, depending on their size, and added those to the wok and cooked for another 5 minutes. Then I added the cherry tomatoes and the basil and cooked those. Then I added the brown rice, the parsley, and the pine nuts. And I tasted it and, you know, and adjust the seasoning. If you want to add a little tamari to that, you could, or salt, a little more salt and pepper, a little more oregano. You know, one of the beauties of being the chef is you really get to taste the food as you're making it and adjust it to your liking. You can also add some red pepper flakes if you want to make it a little spicy. You know, it's really up to you. And this, you know, has a Mediterranean feel to it. You can do this stuffing, and if you wanted to make it more of an Indian flavoring, you can use curry powder instead of the basil and the oregano. I mean, you know, one of the things that I really like to share is the freedom to choose what you're in the mood for and adjust your recipe for that. So at the end, I added the Kalamata olives, the capers, and the pine nuts. And if you were going to go the Indian route, obviously you wouldn't add those things. So again, you just adjust it and make it to your likings. And then I filled the large vegetables that I had cut in half with the vegetable mixture. I baked it at 375 for about another 15 minutes. And then removed it and served it to on a platter, garnished it with some oranges, and voila, it was beautiful. It's a beautiful presentation, and it makes everybody so happy. So enjoy it. I love feedback. If you do decide to make it, let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week. Gwendolyn Hall-Smith is the founder and executive director of Global Community Initiatives, which is a nonprofit organization that was established in 2002. And their intention is to work with communities to implement the Earth Charter. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Earth Charter this morning. But it's the first international document in human history that recognizes the connection between respect and care for the whole community of life, ecological integrity, social and economic justice, democracy, nonviolence, and peace. And Gwen is also the author of several books, The Key to Sustainable Cities, Meeting Human Needs, Transforming Community Systems, Taking Action for Sustainability, The Earth Cat, Guide to Community Development, LASER, Local Action for Sustainable Economic Renewal, Creating Wealth, Growing Local Economies with Local Currencies, and Community Currency and Vermont Dollars, Vermont Cents. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you, Gwendolyn Hall-Smith. Gwen, are you with me?
Yeah, I am. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And
so
what
much.
A great recipe. You made me hungry.
Well, make it. It's so good. I'm sure you live in Vermont, so I'm sure you have a garden up there as well.
Oh, you bet.
I'm sure. And sometime I'd love to visit it because it sounds like you live on a really beautiful place. But you have your hands in so many wonderful projects. But I want to hear about the Earth Charter, about your community. But I also, as you know, brought you on to talk about public banking, which is something that's been brought into my awareness, you know, only recently this year. And I really would like to explore that a little bit more with you. But first, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into working with the Global Community Initiatives and finding it, being the founder.
Right. Well, I worked for the Institute for Sustainable Communities, which is another organization here in Vermont, for many years. And as part of that work, I was exposed to the Earth Charter as it was being introduced to local communities around the world at the ICLEI conference in Wittenberg, Germany, back in 2000, a long time ago. 18 years, wow.
Uh-huh.
So I worked here in Vermont after that conference both to create a big celebration of the Earth Charter, which was actually the outcome of the Rio Earth Summit back in 1992. It was the Rio Summit was supposed to produce this document that was intended to have the same soft law role in international law as, say, the Declaration on Human Rights, and try to provide a framework for international law that would counterbalance what unfortunately now is the very strong tendency to favor corporate profits over people, planet, and social justice issues. So that failed in Rio, and it failed again in Johannesburg in 2002. But meanwhile, in the process of working on that, I became really aware of how local communities themselves are at the front line of most environmental issues, because everything that is polluting the planet is based somewhere. And I've had a long history also as a land use planner for local governments, and it occurred to me that, wow, we really need to find a way for local communities to use the Earth Charter in their planning documents, so that right on the front line we have that same legal basis that we were trying to achieve and failed at the international level. And so that gave rise to the birth of global community initiatives, because I went on to develop a workbook for communities to use in their planning process. That workbook you cited is one of my publications. It's called the EarthCat Guide, and it's available for free online, along with most of my books. And if people want one that isn't free online, just let me know. I'll figure out a way to send it to you electronically. My goal with writing is never to make a lot of money, but mm-hmm. to try and expand the knowledge and experience that people have working with these issues. So that's how I got into it. I actually had a bit of a spiritual insight around it at the moment that I was introduced to it in Wittenberg, because I was at the time I was in divinity school and I was studying the Protestant Reformation. And of course, Ickley picked the church where Martin Luther tacked his theses to the door, which gave rise to that Reformation. And it really was inspiring to me. I thought, that's right. We need to understand in our spiritual traditions as well, the important links between being a good steward of the earth, social justice, and local communities, because local communities really are where most things happen. You know, if you look at local governments all over the world, they are the largest collective governments that we have, not the nation states. Nation states, I think, are soon to be a thing of the past. They're already bought and sold by the corporate sector, and yet the local governments, I think, have a lot of promise in terms of their ability to deal with issues that affect both humanity and the natural environment where they're based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's something that has become more apparent with the current administration, when you realize that you really have, we have so little power when it comes to affecting that and changing that. It's all about, you know, those people with power and money. But on the local right. level, you know, that's why I talked about trying to upseat our local Republican, who's been, you know, not very good for our communities for a long time, and we might actually have a chance. And so, you know, we need to start looking at some of our local governments here. You know, and I'm talking to people living in my community here on Long Island, because I think in general, people are just apathetic. People don't get involved. You know, they go about their day and, you know, stay in their little cocoon. So,
I wish I agreed with you that it was apathy. I think I spent a lot of my formative years thinking that all we need to do is educate people and we'll have this amazing reformation and people will wake up and do things right. And I've actually, over time, lost my faith in that. Sad but true. I tend to think that partly because of conversations I have with people, that it's not apathy. It's almost willful compliance and willful complicity in a lot of cases. I wish it was apathy, because that's an easier thing maybe to address, or ignorance, than actually saying, well, yeah, I think white people are the superior to colored people, and I think we ought to maintain that worldview despite all the harm it's doing around the planet, things like that. You know, I, mm-hmm. I'm sorry if that sounds a little less positive than I might otherwise, but I just wish it was as easy as activating people or educating people. I think that it's a paradigm change we're talking about on a number of different levels, and paradigm changes are different than other forms of activism in many ways. And I think that also is true of the issue with public banks and banking. You know, that's a paradigm change. Public banks aren't necessarily something that is going to be enacted easily as a government program, like a lot of things you might imagine could be done that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up before we go into
the business model of banking completely.
Before we go into talking about it, can you just give my audience a little background on what is a public bank? I think we're really at the beginning. So let's start.
Sure, a public bank. Right from the very beginning, a public bank is a bank that's owned by the public. Full stop. Mm-hmm.
Simple.
And being owned by the public, that means that its benefits flow to the public. So unlike a credit union, which is also a very admirable institution, I'm not bashing credit unions, but they are owned by their members. So they aren't fundamentally a public entity. They're a private entity, admittedly a little more democratic than some other forms of financial institutions because they are owned by their members and their members have a lot of say in how they're governed, but they're not owned by shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the difference. So a public bank is owned by the public, and the benefits, the profits, flow to the public. So in the one example of a public bank that we have here in the United States, which is based in North Dakota, the North Dakota state of North Dakota owns the public bank. And all of the profits that go to that bank are shared with the general fund of North Dakota. Over the last 10 years, over $500 million has been transferred from the bank into the general fund to offset taxes and fees that the government would actually otherwise have to spend on public services. So it's a real success story, in fact, although it's a success story that probably isn't easily replicable, unfortunately, and also had quite a hard start. So it didn't happen all that easily, the Bank of North Dakota. And I think it's a lesson for people working on public banks to learn from in terms of the level of opposition that's possible when you're pursuing that as a goal, and also the kind of challenges you might face from the private banking sector.
Mm-hmm. Right, because they'd be in line to lose a lot of money, obviously. But I would think that states would be looking to the Bank of North Dakota if they could see all the profit coming back to the city. Why wouldn't every state want to have public banking? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer if it's going to put more money into the infrastructure and, lower taxes, et cetera.
It does seem like a no-brainer. I agree. It's an interesting story that also I think is related to what I was saying before about some level of complicity in what happens on that level of government. But back after the crash in 2008, there were a lot of states that started looking at public banking, about 22 of them around the country, and Vermont was one. I was leading the effort here, partly because of the book I wrote called Creating Wealth, which is really about the problems of the monetary system. And so I convened a group of people here in Vermont that included senators and business leaders, activists, academics, really across the board to talk about what we could do in Vermont to help mitigate the problematic impacts of the monetary system as a whole. And we came up with a number of strategies, one of which was complementary currencies, another of which was public banking. We launched a new complementary currency here in central Vermont called the Onion River Exchange, which is a time bank, a way of making exchanges with each other based on time rather than money, which is mm-hmm. a very popular form of complementary currency available across the country. I'm sure there's one in Long Island. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure you could find one there or start one there. Mm-hmm. They're not that difficult to start.
Yeah, I interviewed someone who had started Hour. Have you heard of that? Our Hour. They're also a bartering time bank type of thing where everyone's time is equal and,
Yeah. There's a lot of different kinds around the country, and I just recommend you look into it if you're interested in that sort of thing. But we also started working on a public bank here in Vermont because the people on this committee I had convened thought that it was the low-hanging fruit in a way. It had been looked at a little bit in Vermont before. The joint fiscal office of our legislature had looked at it and said it was worthy of more study. And, of course, with a lot of the anger and understandable animosity toward the banks after the crash, they felt it was a good time to introduce it as well. And so we worked on passing legislation to do a study of what the economic impacts would be of a public bank in Vermont. And even that simple step of doing a study to examine how public banks might benefit the state was fought vigorously by the banking industry. And it failed. Even though we had over 80 legislators signing on to the legislation to begin with, it failed, which was my introduction essentially to how powerful the banking lobby is, even in a very small state like Vermont, because it was a no-brainer. You know, like you say, why shouldn't we be looking at all the ways that we can raise revenue and improve our infrastructure and public services without raising taxes? So we raised our own money to do our own study. I raised the money from the Donella Meadows Institute, which doesn't exist anymore, but it used to be based in Heartland, Vermont, and it was named after its founder, Donella Meadows, who was a dear friend of mine. She was one of the authors of The Limits to Growth. And they funded the study, and we hired the University of Vermont and the University of Massachusetts to do it for us. It was the Political and Economic Research Institute at University of Massachusetts and the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics at the University of Vermont. And they found, using the same economic modeling software that the legislature used in their own policy analysis and peer-reviewed by the state economists, that if we had a public bank in Vermont, it would raise over $340 million in gross state product. It would create over 2,500 jobs, which in Vermont is about 15% of our unemployment rate. It's not insignificant. We're a very small state, and would add lots of money to the state coffers as well. Now, there again, any policy that you can pass at a state level that would do that in a time of economic crisis and downturn should be a no-brainer. So we went back at the legislature with the results of the study. I organized a town meeting campaign where 20 cities and towns from around Vermont directed the legislature to establish a state bank, and it still failed because of the power of the banking lobby. So that was another object lesson in why legislators don't always use data to make their decisions. In fact, I was called an anti-capitalist and a communist because I was pushing for this idea of a public bank. I was fired from my job. There was this huge public scandal. And it was all at the hands of the banking lobby. So that's when I really started deeply thinking about what it would take to get this kind of policy passed. Now, the good news is we did have a little success. They didn't set up a public bank, but with all the public pressure, the legislature did establish what they called the 10% for Vermont program, where the treasurer is now authorized to directly invest 10% of her average daily balance in the state's economy. And so that was our average daily balance here in Vermont, as a small state, is about $350 million a day. And so that put $35 million into the state's economy as direct loans to the Vermont Economic Development Authority, the Vermont Housing Finance Agency, the Vermont Municipal Bond Bank, that all the public lending agencies that we already have here in Vermont were able to access that money. And we built $10 million more of solar projects. We insulated the state office buildings, low-income houses got weatherization programs provided. So there was a lot of good that came out of that effort, even if it failed. But meanwhile, the Public Banking Institute, which is a national organization dedicated to educating people about public banking, brought Global Community Initiatives and me on as a consultant to help them with their projects. And so I started looking at how it could succeed. What would it take for a public banking initiative to succeed? And my determination really was that, again, it's a paradigm change. Paradigm changes are difficult. If you think about the ones that we've known about even in our lifetime, for example, when I was first in the workforce, it was commonplace for people to smoke at work, even in a public sector job, right? I'm sure that's probably true for you, too. I don't know how old you are, but back when we were young, smoking at work was normal. And nowadays, you can't even smoke on the streets in some communities because it's considered unhealthy and illegal in some cases. So that's a huge paradigm change against a very powerful industry, right, that was successful. So it isn't impossible that these things happen. It's just difficult. Look at all it took to change the paradigm around smoking and apartheid and, you know, these sorts of issues that are very important issues really require a lot of work and campaigning, but they work on a different level than just a policy initiative does. You know, it's got to be a mindset change among a vast swath of the population. And how do you get those mindset changes is a good question, too. You know, it's when you look at those other things, there were a lot of health data that was provided to the public by even the government about the harm of smoking. You can look at Lady Bird Johnson's Keep America Beautiful campaign that made littering to be a problem. And yet, if you look at that same type of thing happening from the government around banking, given that the banks practically own the government, it's very unlikely. So it's going to take, you know, probably another economic crisis, because crisis is another good time for people to wake up to the fact that something fundamental about our society is really not working in their favor, or another concerted effort, maybe funded by some benefactor, that would help people understand the problem, because it is a huge problem. The monetary system and the banking system rob the rest of us of our birthright, and they do it in a way that is insulated from even a lot of knowledge about what's going on. It's not in our education system, really, what's going on in banks. The economists are taught one thing when the reality is something else. Even the Nobel Peace Prize, right, for economics, has never been awarded to anybody that's criticized the banking system, because the Nobel Prize in Economics wasn't actually invented by Alfred Nobel. It was a banker's prize developed by the central bank in Sweden. Now, since this has come to light, they have made it more clear when they award that prize that it's not really the same kind of Nobel Prize as the rest of them. But, you know, it's still something that is worth considering, how powerful the entities are that keep us from knowing more about what's going on in our economy and what's going on in our lives as a result of that economy. I can talk, though. You must have more questions.
I do have a lot more questions, but let's actually take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I actually want to delve into, you know, a little bit some of the real problems with the current monetary system and what changes, you know, where do you see... Where do we start, basically? I mean, it's just, like you said, it's so complex.
Sounds good.
So, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Gwendolyn Hall-Smith from Global Community Initiatives, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial, free, and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more. that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media. So Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
Hey folks, my name is Jordan Valerie. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And I'm here to tell you about the Millennial Politics Podcast. We speak with the next generation of progressive candidates, activists, and organizations dedicated to restoring our democracy and protecting our civil rights and liberties. Make sure to stay tuned for Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, to hear the most recent episode of our podcast and follow us on social media and iTunes to stay up to date with everything Millennial Politics.
Known as a gadget guy, but I love gadgets that really do the trick, like the new app. The Progressive Radio Network has an app, thanks to our friends at Audio Now. Hey, this is Mark Farrell, host of Insight on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we broadcast live out of New York City. But if you can't catch the show live, no frets. It's always archived. It's always on the app. Download it now, listen later, whenever you want. The Progressive Radio Network app is available from our friends at Audio Now. Check it out.
And welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Gwendolyn Hallsmith, the founder of Global Community Initiatives. And we're talking about public banking and how that impacts or how that could impact our society in a positive way and what's wrong with our current money system. So, Gwen, are you with me?
Yep.
So let's talk the current money system that we have right now. How does that negatively impact us on a daily basis? Like, what, you know, how would a loan from a public bank work versus a loan, let's say, from a traditional bank?
Okay, that's a great question. A public bank would make a loan, say, to a solar business that's growing in Vermont, for example, mm-hmm. and that loan would be paid back with interest to that public bank. In a private bank, the interest payment is basically the cost of the money, they say, and the interest that is paid on that loan goes to the shareholders of the bank. In a public bank, the interest goes to the owners of the bank, which are the public. So the interest payments go into the bank that's being used as a lending agency on the public basis, and like in North Dakota, where $500 million over the last 10 years have gone to the North Dakota General Fund to help offset taxes, that money can be used for public purpose. It's not always instantly used that way, mind you. Banks do cost money to run, and so some of the money has to go to both covering the bank's costs and covering the risks of lending, which are things like loan loss reserves and default reserves, so that if the loans go bad, the taxpayer isn't left on the hook for the loans. But this mitigates, the fact that the money goes to the public rather than the private sector mitigates the otherwise very damaging effect of the type of monetary system that we have. Because right now, virtually all the money that comes into existence as debt. So when banks issue loans, they're effectively creating new money. But it's not new money that the government prints and makes available in the economy at no cost. All of this new money comes with interest attached. When you look on a systemic level, what happens when all of that interest is attached to the money that we're using, it's basically a giant sucking sound upward, extracting money from people that don't have it and transferring it to the people that do. So the existence of the now well-known 1% in our society that was the subject of the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2000, 11 on, is actually due to the monetary system. They got it right by occupying Wall Street, because the banks are the source of the inequality in our system. But again, this understanding is not widely shared or widely known because of the bank's virtual ownership of the economic discipline. You know, the bank economists are taught early on not to question money. They're taught that it's a medium of exchange, a unit of account, a store of value. They're not taught that it's a privately owned interest-bearing mechanism by which the wealthy extract money from the poor. And so understanding it in a more deep way is a challenge for anybody, because you will be told, even by people who are supposed to know, that that's not the way it works and it can't be that way and you're wrong, you know. And I know, because I've experienced this a lot since writing the book that I wrote with Bernard Liotard, who used to work as a central banker in Belgium. He actually helped invent the euro back when it was first developed, and so knew really up close and personal what was involved in the banking business, and worked within the bank for a while to try and fix it, but then it was made very clear to him that that wasn't the bank's purpose, changing the monetary system. In fact, the central banks are really put there to maintain the monetary system that we have, not to change it. And that's when he left and started doing more activist work on changing the system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure that provoked a question. I mean, it's not intuitive, that this stuff, unfortunately, it flies in the face of our sensibilities in a lot of cases. What do you mean all money is debt? You know, how does that work? That's a challenging idea itself. And yet, if you think about it, when banks, we call it the fractional reserve system. That's a bit of a, what would you call it, a nickname for the way banks work. The way banks work is actually pretty simple. They are allowed to use an accounting system that's different than other businesses. So when a bank takes your cash as a deposit, if you know anything about accounting, it becomes a liability for the bank. You know, we tend to think of our cash on deposit as an asset because it's an asset for us. That's our money in the bank.
Right.
But for a bank that owes you that money, if you come in and ask for it, it's a liability. Okay, so they're not the bank's assets. The bank's assets are the debts that they have, the promises that they have from people to repay the money that they've lent out. So what happens when a loan is made is, you know, you never get a loan from a bank if you're not a depositor there. You have to have a deposit account first. Mm-hmm. The loan that they're making to you goes from being an account payable to a deposit, both in the liabilities column for the bank. So it changes it from one type of liability to another type of liability. And that in that moment, that's when the bank lending process creates new money, effectively. It's pretty simple. It's been going on for hundreds of years. It's a lot of the reason that we have the system we have in place now. And, you know, this money creation function is a valuable function, if you think about it. It's not all evil. It's only a problem when it serves to consolidate wealth in the hands of fewer and fewer people, which is unfortunately the way it's been behaving since the banks have been privately owned. If a bank was publicly owned, then the money creation function and all of that profit essentially would be going to the public sector and helping fund infrastructure, education, all the kinds of things that we need as a human family.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, not to change the subject, but I was thinking about the micro loans that are, you know, that are being made to people in other parts of the world for, you know, mostly to women for agriculture. You know, and then I heard of of, you know, fake microloans that were being offered by, you know, banks in this country. You know, and I guess I'm just questioning, you know, the transparency and, you know, and the trickery that had to be behind that in order to, you know, false advertising or whatever, to be able to make loans that actually sucked more money from people, that, like you talk about, you know, charging people that don't have the money, you know, and, you know, that the loans that go to people, you know, mostly women working on these agricultural projects really need the money, and, you know, and they kind of trick them, and I don't know.
I have a bit of a contrarian view about microlending. I think, you know, putting people who are in poverty in debt is a bad idea, actually. And I think if you look at the experience that microlending has had, it tends to support that notion. I mean, there are some cases where it succeeds, just like in our economy. There's some people that actually manage to go from being a really low-income person to a wealthy person. They're really, really, really rare. Your prediction of whether or not you will be comfortable in your life as a human being in our society is very, very much dependent on how you were born, what resources your parents had when you were born, and not on your own industriousness or hardworking Puritan ethic. You know, and so sure, there are microloans that benefit people and have made it possible for women who otherwise would not have the opportunity to start their own business to start it. But as a systemic way of dealing with poverty, they are a failure. And that makes sense, because what are you doing? You're taking people who are poor without adequate resources and you're putting them in debt. Sort of the same way we do with our young people in this country with student loans. You know, the only way they can find to get ahead in our system is by getting a decent education. Again, unless they're born with resources that can help them do that. And what do? We say, okay, you want to get a decent education, you've got to take out this loan because the price of college has gotten so exorbitantly high that it's the only way you can afford to pay the bills. And you are basically going to be living in poverty for the rest of your life because of the way our loan system is structured. There's no way most of our students these days can afford to pay off their debts, but they're legally constrained against filing for bankruptcy when they run into trouble with it. They have more debt when they come out of the college system than they would need even to buy a house or start a business. And it's just to pay for their education. Mm-hmm. So, again, but it's, to me, it seems that it's part of the need for widespread understanding of the problem, because until there is more widespread understanding of the problem, it's going to be hard to address it in any meaningful way. People don't understand that when they take out a loan, they're going to be paying three times the cost of whatever it was back to their lender before the debt is finalized. It's interesting because I'm actually writing a book right now, a novel about the early settlement of the United States. It's sort of been a hobby of mine for a while. And so I've been writing about indentured servitude. And actually, indentured servitude was a better deal. It was easier and better to be an indentured servant back then than it is now to be a student in need of a student loan. At least the indentured servitude was ended after 7 years. You had to be a slave for 7 years, but then things got better and you were able to have your own land and start your own business and all the kinds of things that most human beings want to be able to do. So,
I never looked at it that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, because to me anyway, once you see the problem, you can't unsee it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's there. And that's a challenge too, because it's heartbreaking when you realize that we could do things differently. Absolutely could do things differently. There's plenty of examples from all over the world of money systems and banking systems that work quite differently than the one we have now. But the one we have now is such a dominant global model that almost nobody can challenge it successfully. And what that means, unfortunately, is that I believe it's going to take another crisis before we see a real change in that area, that effectively that the system is going to implode on itself before we consciously change it. And I think that's sad, but I also don't see any way around it, unfortunately. Meanwhile, there are ways you can address the problem locally, getting back to the local theme.
Tell us.
Which are things like setting up a time bank and working on alternative exchange systems so that people in your community do have alternatives to the money system for basic needs. The time bank that we have here in central Vermont has been very successful in that respect. People trade everything from rides to the airport to cooking to gardening to accounting to, you know, when you're starting up a business, needing to do the initial marketing for it. Anything you can spend your time on is a legitimate topic, a legitimate thing to exchange in a time bank. There's also business barter systems that work very successfully now as a parallel system to the current monetary system. So,
now, wasn't there something with time banks where they were trying to tax the monetary value of that barter, or am I thinking of something else?
There's some misinformation about time banks that I think in some cases has been deliberate. Time banking has a IRS ruling from many years ago that allows it to be non-taxable. And that is one of the beauties of it in a way, because it enables people to raise their standard of living without losing access to things like the benefits that they need for childcare or housing. There's a lot of implications to the taxability of something beyond whether you actually are going to pay a tax. Because if it's considered income, then it's going to be added to your income side. And if you go over that cliff, you know, the benefits cliff, you're in trouble. So there is an IRS ruling that makes that impossible.
Mm-hmm.
From the IRS point of view, a time bank is the same as volunteer time, which in the United States is not taxed. But like I said, time banking, even though it's a fairly common, easy, readily available way.
Oh, no, we're out of time. I can't believe it.
Speaking of time banking.
Quickly, Gwen, can you share with people how to get in touch with you and where they can find out more information about the Time Bank Institute?
Sure. My website is www.global-community.org. And if you write to me through the website, that's great. I am always available for speaking engagements and helping people set up complementary currency systems, helping people if they want to start a public bank initiative. Happy to help.
Thank you. Well, I will share all that information on my website, too. Gwen, thank you so much for joining me. You're awesome, and you're so full of so much information. Thank you. And everyone listening,
yeah,
thanks
thank
for
you.
Joining us. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.
Happy